From the Mom Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, me Martinez. What Iranian Americans need to know before traveling outside of the country as Iran-U.S. tensions continue to rise. Plus, California probation officers want to stop sending teenagers to prisons with adults.
They're being socialized by more sophisticated adults, which makes them more sophisticated criminals when they come out.
It's all ahead on Take 2. Stay with us. Glad to have you with us on a Monday. There's a lot to share with you in today's show, from some drama aboard the Queen Mary in Long Beach to get back in ship shape to the alternative ways to treat pain that are not reliant on drugs such as opioids. How about some virtual reality on that? That's coming up. First, though, a heads up on some breaking news today in Hollywood. And as you heard on NPR's newscast, former producer Harvey Weinstein has been charged with 4 counts of sexual assault in L.A. County, stemming from separate incidents in 2013 involving 2 women. Here's Jackie Lacey, L.A. County District Attorney, in announcing the charges just hours ago.
We believe the evidence will show that the defendant used his power and influence to gain access to his victims and then committed violent crimes against them.
Weinstein has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing, but if convicted, he would face 28 years in prison. It complicates the legal issues for him as he faces similar charges in New York City, and that trial is set to begin this month. In about half an hour, we'll get more of the latest from The Frame's John Horn. First, though, we turn to the U.S. and Iran, where the rhetoric between the two countries is heating up and fast. It comes after an American strike last week took out one of Iran's top military leaders, Qasem Soleimani. And now this geopolitical fight has trickled down into the daily lives of several Americans. Dozens of Iranians and Iranian Americans were stopped and questioned last week by U.S. officials at the border in Washington state. They were trying to return from an Iranian pop concert in Canada. One of them was Nigar Hekmati.
It's not okay. And for me as an immigrant, I'm used to it, unfortunately. But for my kids, it shouldn't be okay. And I'm afraid that's a slippery slope.
Many, just like her in Southern California, have questions about what this means now for anyone with an Iranian background and the problems they might face as well when flying into LAX or crossing over the U.S.-Mexico border. With us to discuss the situation is Asal Rad, research fellow at the National Iranian American Council. She is based in Irvine. Also with us, Smirnoush Yazdanyar, principal lawyer at Yazdanyar Law Offices in L.A. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much.
Mirnusha, let's start with you. Why might Iranians in Southern California be reluctant to travel?
Well, it's not just some Iranians in Southern California. Unfortunately, as we've seen in this administration, even before the events of 2020 occurred, just Iranians, any Iranians, legal permanent residents, citizens, when traveling, coming back into the country, have been subject to secondary inspection and additional questioning. What is particularly problematic in this case is that it's not just linked to Iranians traveling to Iran and coming back, where we can say, okay, the government has reasons to want to maybe get additional information regarding their travels, what they have with them, what they're bringing. It's just Iranian Americans or anyone linked to Iran that traveled from the U.S. to Canada trying to come back and being stopped at the border and being questioned, because it's unclear why this is occurring. There is no there's no clear reasoning behind what the government is doing. And in fact, there have been instances where the government is denying that they have even been questioning and detaining Iranians. So it is very important if you're traveling abroad to really know, depending on your immigration status as well, to make sure you're protected and you know your rights.
Does it feel like a scarlet red letter?
Yes, and this has been the case for years and years and years now. It's obviously heightened under this administration. I mean, my background is a sanctions attorney, and I've seen every single day the impact that this the relations between U.S. and Iran has on average Iranians or Americans of Iranian descent living here who have no ties to the Iranian government. Simply, they're just first and second generation. They have family and assets abroad, and they need to effectuate basic transactions with this country, and they can't. And then events like this, or with the travel ban, just escalates things further, and I think highlights these issues. These issues exist on a daily basis.
Asal Rad, what have you been hearing from people traveling through LAX?
We've had some reports from folks in LAX who have said they've gotten extra questioning. It hasn't been as They haven't been held as long as what we saw with the concert, the Vancouver to Washington situation that we saw yesterday. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't been as dramatic, I would say, but they have still noted the fact that they are getting extra questions. And of course, these are people who have traveled, you know, they've traveled consistently in the past, and they're noticing a distinct difference in the way they're being treated now.
What kinds of extra questions are they being asked?
Well, I mean, there are reports that say they're being asked about their opinions about the situation with Iran, which, you know, feels like a completely inappropriate question, because immediately you think to yourself, this is a question of loyalty. And why Iranian Americans should be questioned is ridiculous. I mean, we're Americans like any other American. And this has been the issue with our community for some time. As Mayor Kamish noted, you know, there's been enmity between these two states for 40 years. And for those of us who were, I myself was born in the U.S. after the revolution and have no ties to anything having to do with Iran. And yet I'm still treated like, or sometimes feel like, I'm not really an American. And that's, I think, the moment where something has gone wrong, if this is the feeling and the sentiment that exists in the community.
Mirnoush, you're an attorney. What would you advise someone to say or to answer when that gets asked? Do you just tell them to say what they feel, or just the answer that would get them out of there as quickly as possible?
No, I think so. There's the organizations and within the community, NIAC being one of them, have done a great job of laying out what you can and cannot, what you should and shouldn't, you know, answer. I feel like it's just a very dangerous slippery slope when we are giving carte blanche to our government officials at the border to do whatever they see fit. And there is not a clear criteria as to what questions they're asking and why. So as an Iranian American, unfortunately, we've kind of accepted, as you heard from the testimony that you had, we're in a situation where if we travel to Iran and come back, because of the nature of the relationship between these two countries, we're going to be subject to certain additional questions. For example, under the sanctions, we're not permitted to bring certain goods of Iranian origin. So that might be something that's logical for the government official to ask you, or how much currency you have with you, or what your purpose of travel was. But beyond that, going into political viewpoints and personal beliefs and wanting to check your personal belongings for, that is a violation of privacy, and that you are not required to ask that. But the most important thing I would say for anyone listening is, if you're traveling wherever, make sure that your immigration status, your paperwork and documents are 100% in order, and make sure that you are in touch with an attorney, because we are experiencing, I mean, we're getting so many calls from people that everything is in order. Most of them, thankfully, have only led to an inconvenience of being, you know, questioned, and the unfortunate feeling that gives you for several hours. But it's just, I don't know.
What about some more basics? You mentioned, you know, to know the status, but what about, should you have cash on hand to make sure that in case, I don't know, that you're not away from your phone or an ATM, that you have some availability of cash?
You don't. I mean, it's more cash for people who travel. It's a very big issue of bringing more than $10,000 with you into the country, or taking it with you out and not reporting it. So people, I mean, you don't necessarily need to have cash, but perhaps most importantly is to make sure that we have, like, a lot of clients that are traveling back and forth that have had family members notify us, okay, so-and-so is coming in on this date. So that if something should happen where they can't get a hold of them, you know, you do have access to an attorney, or you have access to somebody that can get you help if you're detained for an unreasonable period of time.
Asalrad, what other resources are there for Iranians and Iranian Americans who are traveling?
Well, you know, we've reached out to IAVA. We work with CARE. We work with all these organizations that have already become a coalition because of the travel ban, right? So this is sort of, this is not something new, unfortunately, that this community is dealing with, because the travel ban affected the Iranian American population more than any other of the countries that was stated in the actual ban. And so there's already, you know, a community in place to reach out, to help, to have volunteers, to get that information to them. And the most important thing that we can do is, I think, advocacy, right? We need to realize that this is tied to our inability to represent ourselves in the way that laws are being implemented. And that plays into the travel ban itself. We have to hold our officials accountable. You know, right now the CPB is saying there is no directive. They tweeted this yesterday, as if to say that the reports that are coming out are false, which is also, you know, wildly unfair. So what is CPB's answer? That these are people who are making all of these stories up, and it's happening in multiple places where they're, you know, hubs of travel where Iranian Americans are traveling. So, you know, we need to hold our government accountable. We need to have legal advice, which is what someone like Ms. Yazanyar, you know, provides for us, but we also need advocacy that says there is a legal issue behind all of it anyway.
Assal, I'm going to have to leave it right there. Assal Rad, Research Fellow at the National Iranian American Council based in Irvine. Mirnoush Yazanyar, Principal Lawyer at Yazanyar Law Offices in L.A. My thanks to you both.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, let's turn now to California's juvenile justice system, which is expected to go through some big changes under new leadership in 2020. For example, the state's chief probation officers have several big goals for reforming the system in the coming years, from renovating facilities to raising the maximum age for youth detention. LA County's probation chief, Terry McDonald, has ideas on what should be done as well. She's leaving her position this month, and the LA County Board of Supervisors is expected to choose a new chief tomorrow. But before she leaves, she wanted to share with us what she's learned in her time and what her successor needs to address. Chief McDonald, welcome to Take Two.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. Now, just to start off, what's your philosophy of juvenile justice?
Well, I think California's done a remarkable job over the last decade to really begin to understand what drives young people into the juvenile justice system. You know, maybe 15 years ago, California talked about super predators, young children who would get involved in gang activity that were irredeemable in nature. Over the last decade, that's changed profoundly, where people understand the trauma and the development of the brain that adolescents are going through that often drive them into the criminal justice system. And so treating young people through that lens, understanding that there are things going on at home, in school, instead of just deciding that young people need to be locked away for long periods of time.
Now, the chief probation officers of California, the CPOC, are trying to reform the juvenile justice system. Are you behind their proposal to reclassify what it means to be a juvenile in the eyes of the law so that an 18 or 19-year-old won't be viewed as an adult?
Well, it's interesting because going from 17 to 18 is the difference of a day. Going from 18 to 19 is a difference of a day. And what the probation officers are talking about is using the science of adolescent brain development and the understanding that really up to the age of 25, young brains are still developing. And it makes more sense to raise the age of jurisdiction to treat an 18-year-old more like a 16-year-old than like a 30-year-old.
Is there an LA-specific reason for changing it in that way? Is there anything about LA County itself that would make things better for those in the system now?
Yeah, I think LA is unique. It's much more like a state than most counties in California. LA County, the jails, it's the largest jail system in America. They've got roughly 18,000 prisoners in there. And to place an 18 or 19-year-old into the Los Angeles County jail system is not going to get you better outcomes when those young people come out. They're easily victimized. They're oftentimes convinced to engage in misconduct, whether it's trafficking narcotics into and out of the jail or moving weapons, because they don't have the maturity to tell the older adults, I'm not going to do that. They're being socialized by more sophisticated adults, which makes them more sophisticated criminals when they come out, versus a juvenile system where they're small and the facilities have case managers for every young person that's in there and you're working with them. Also, LA County worked with the state to redesign one of our juvenile camps, Campus Kilpatrick, into a national model for the future of juvenile detention. And so LA is staged to really lead the state and lead the nation in how the design of the facilities would look better, as well as having program models that'll get you better outcomes.
And you mentioned Camp Kilpatrick. That's located in the Santa Monica Mountains of Western LA County, Malibu area. Tell us what that looks like for someone that is there.
Well, unfortunately, the facility was subject to the big Malibu fire. So we've had it, we've had the kids removed from that facility for about a year. They're going back in January. The scenery in itself is lovely. You know, you're up in the mountains there. But when you enter the facility, it's a secure facility. There's fencing around it. But the fencing doesn't have barbed wire or big walls that you feel like you're entering a lockup center. And when you go inside the housing, the living units where the boys are, they live in small dorms, about five boys to a dorm. There's a living room within the area where the staff work with them. So it would remind you more like a high school campus that has living environments than a jail that has a classroom in it.
We're talking to LA County Probation Chief Terry McDonald. Now, back in August, LA County supervisors have voted on a motion to take steps to remove LA's juvenile justice system from probation's oversight. Where does that stand now?
Well, they've got hired a consultant, and there's a group of folks, county folks, community-based organization folks, thought leaders, thinking about, you know, how should that be accomplished? What would it take to do it? What should the future of juvenile probation in Los Angeles County look like?
Now, last year, supervisors banned the use of pepper spray in juvenile detention halls, and you said it would take until 2020 to phase that out. Is your department on track with that?
Well, we're still moving forward with it. We're working with the board and the chief executive office and the Department of Mental Health right now to put together the resource needs to begin to remove it. And we've been training staff in how would you address misconduct and violent misconduct without the use of pepper spray? And how do we engage in programs and training that really de-escalates before you need to use any force at all? I think you'll see in early 2020 the finalized plan in how to fully implement that.
Wondering, Chief, you announced plans to leave last September. How much of your departure is connected to these changes that are afoot?
None. When I took the job, I had left LA County 3 years ago because I live in Sacramento and my family's in Sacramento and my life is really in Sacramento. So when I was asked to come down to help, I was pretty clear with the board that I was happy to help. I was honored to get the job, but I really owed it to my family not to do a long-term commitment.
Now, one last thing, you mentioned how your life is in Sacramento. Will it be your work as well, or are you kind of just saying, okay, that's it for me?
You know what? I'm going to take some time to think. You know, I've had the opportunity to oversee the largest state prison system, the largest state parole system, the largest state juvenile justice system, the largest county jail, and now the largest probation department in America. And I've evolved in my thinking around the work, and now I want to take some time, almost sabbatical-like, and think, what am I supposed to do next from the evolution of my own thinking around the work? But I know I'm also, you know, I'm not done.
That's LA County Probation Chief Terry McDonald. Chief, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
One of REM's biggest hits was a song called Everybody Hurts. And in some ways, that's true to different degrees, but there are some folks who every single moment of the day feel horrible, debilitating physical pain that just never stops, never, ever gets better. Coming up, we'll hear from someone who has tried just about everything to feel better and why talking about his pain has really been the best medicine. His story is next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. With opioid overdoses reaching epidemic levels in the United States, doctors are searching for new methods of pain relief. From virtual reality to electric pulses, researchers are hoping to help the 50 million Americans that live with chronic pain without drugs. In about 6 minutes, we'll talk to a reporter who's traveled the world for National Geographic researching these alternative therapies. But first, we turn to Tom Norris of Los Angeles, who's profiled in that National Geographic article. He's one of those many patients here in the U.S. who are seeking relief from years of discomfort. Tom, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you very much.
Since your 30s, you've had chronic pain. You're 70 now, so it's four decades of this. First, how did your pain start?
I had testicular cancer at the age of 35 while I was stationed in Saudi Arabia. Came back and had surgery, 30 days of radiation, And the end result of the radiation is that the cancer disappeared, was gone. And I had scar tissue from my left hip to my pubic bone and up my spine.
What pain do you feel?
It's really hard to describe pain, but I visualize it as fighting a flaming tiger with big, massive claws that open wounds from the back of my neck all the way down to the base of my spine.
So what kinds of things have you tried over the years to alleviate it?
Well, lots of medication initially. When that didn't work, I went to civilian doctors. We tried biofeedback. I found an avant-garde doctor who used magnets, electricity, bee stings, faith healing, hands-on healing, the gauntlet. And that didn't work. So right now I live using epidurals. I'd use, as dangerous as epidurals are, I have a very, very competent doctor who I have faith in. And the epidurals managed to give me, I describe it as a chance to hold the tiger that's clawing me by the neck and pull it away just a little bit.
Have you ever tried fentanyl?
Yes, I did fentanyl for approximately 10 years. I had a civilian doctor who recommended it. We wound up maximizing the dose I took. The loss of mental clarity, the loss of any kind of physical activity. In the long term, it wasn't worth it for me. I felt like I was dying. I had no quality of life. And that's really what I fought for, you know, ever since I started chronic pain, is to have a life that means something and a life that is valued.
Have you accepted the pain as something that you can't get rid of?
Yeah, I really think I have. It's I stay in bed over 50% of the time just to be able to do one thing a day or two things a day. I work very hard mentally to keep my personality alive, but the pain always wins. Sooner or later, always wins.
Tom, there are some people that luckily for them don't deal with chronic pain. For them, maybe pain is something that sends them a message. So I'm doing something, it hurts, stop doing it. So it's a good thing for them to feel this pain because it helps. But for you, for someone like you that's dealing with this all the time, what role does pain play in your life?
My pain reminds me that I'm alive and that I have limits. Pain is the bugaboo for me because it restricts what I have and what I can do. But it makes me value what I have and what I can do.
There's some people I read in the article that don't feel pain, that don't have that in them to feel. Would you rather be one of them? Or is it for you something that, as you said, it reminds you that you're alive, pain?
I thought about that question when I read the article. I would rather feel the pain I have to be aware. To be aware of what's going on, to be aware of my surroundings. I would rather feel the pain.
Tom, you're also a facilitator of chronic pain groups in Los Angeles. Why did you start these groups? And what goes on in there?
These groups are different in that there are no doctors, there are no clinicians or anything else. And what I found out is, personally, it helps me to be able to talk to somebody who knows what I'm going through. They may not be on the same journey I am, but I get a great deal of comfort of knowing that somebody else hurts. I want people to realize that no matter what kind of pain they have, there's always hope. And you may not beat it, but you can live with it. And you can still have, no matter how much pain you have, you still have value.
That's Tom Norris. Tom, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Now we turn to Yudhijit Bhattacharjee, who wrote about alternative therapies being used to help those like Tom who deal with chronic pain every day. And his article now appears in National Geographic. Welcome to Take Two.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, all right, let's start off by just talking about the physical sensation of pain. How and why do we feel hurt?
Well, pain is a very useful thing. Because without pain, we would not be able to preserve our bodies. We wouldn't move away from a fire or wouldn't avoid, you know, obvious pitfalls. So the way that pain works is that pain is an alarm system. We have a set of neurons in the body And anytime we have an injury or we feel intense heat or pressure, a knife's cut, those neurons that are called nociceptors, they will fire, send a pain signal to the spinal cord from which the pain signal is transmitted all the way to the central nervous system, and that's where the pain is experienced.
Now, as we mentioned earlier, people like Tom feel this constant debilitating pain all the time. Other people can't feel any pain at all. Can you give us an example of what those people experience?
In the story, I write about a few such people. One of them is this woman named Jo Cameron, a Scottish woman. She's never experienced pain in her life. When she was growing up, she would often, have these bruises and cuts, and she would discover them days after they had happened. She didn't experience any pain when delivering her two children. And the reason that she and people like her don't experience pain is because of certain mutations in their genes, which make them pain insensitive, which basically don't allow pain signals to travel up from these nociceptors that I described to you earlier up to the spinal cord. So these individuals are actually helping researchers figure out the biology of pain in ways that wouldn't be possible from studying you and me.
We're talking to Udijit Bhattacharjee. He wrote an article for National Geographic called A World of Pain. Now, you also write about more macroscopic ways of dealing with pain, like virtual reality, for example, something that you've actually tried yourself. So tell us, what was VR pain therapy like?
So, you know, I went to this lab in Baltimore, and I put on these virtual reality goggles and then watched this video of life under the ocean. And it was just this beautiful, colorful video of jellyfish and stingrays. I felt like I'd gone on vacation. But then I experienced this sharp pulse of heat on my skin that reminded me that actually I'd come here for a little demonstration of the use of virtual reality to reduce the experience of pain. So it turns out, when I wasn't watching this video, I was only able to tolerate a certain level of heat applied to my skin. But when I was immersed in watching this ocean video that I was describing, my heat tolerance went up by nearly 2 degrees. And this is something that researchers are applying. They've applied it to pediatric units, to kids who have suffered severe burns, and it seems to be working for a lot of patients.
What about the electric pulses that I mentioned up top? How does that work, and what's been the effect on people's pain?
This is a technique called deep brain stimulation, which has been used for certain other illnesses. It's now routinely prescribed for Parkinson's disease. What these doctors did was they put this little electrical device, they implanted this device in a part of the patient's brain that processes sort of emotions, including emotions related to pain, and then delivered very mild electrical pulses to that part of the brain. When they did that, the patients were actually able to relax more, and they experienced none of the trauma and the anxiety associated with the anticipation of pain. So even though the pain itself ultimately, when it came, was about the same, it felt about the same as it did before, the unpleasantness of the pain experience was greatly reduced by this deep brain stimulation.
You know, I'm wondering where this goes, where the future of pain management goes, because Udijit, if we ever get to a point where we can completely control that sensation, that natural sensation that tells us that there is something that we shouldn't be doing or something dangerous, I mean, it sounds like a Pandora's box, right? Something that people could want when they don't necessarily need it. So where does this go from here?
You know, we certainly wouldn't be better off in a world without pain entirely. We would have no experience of pleasure, I think, without the experience of pain. I don't mean to get philosophical here, but our, you know, our state of being is contingent on feeling both of those things, you know, pain and pleasure. I can't imagine a world in which there is no pain, because if there is no pain, then I think that there are some consequences to it. I think we would probably, you know, we would scald ourselves, you know, in fires. We would probably start taking risks. I think we would self-destruct.
That's journalist Udijit Buddhasharji. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You should know by now that with the calendar flipping to 2020, there are some new laws in California's books. But all the bills that didn't make it are not necessarily dead. Some still have a legislative pulse, but the clock is definitely ticking. Coming up, we'll tell you about a few Senate and Assembly bills that are still trying their best to become laws. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. All right, some big news coming down today with the case against Harvey Weinstein, John Horn, the frame. That's at 3:30 today. Going to have the latest on it, John.
Yeah, there's two developments. One is in New York. The trial started, and trial is not really starting, but it's the beginning of procedures in New York, where he is charged with first-degree rape, two counts of predatory sexual assault, one count of first-degree sexual assault, and one count of third-degree rape. They're going to start jury selection. They think it's going to take a couple of weeks, so we might not have opening statements in that case probably till mid to late January. But just as court was being adjourned in New York, here in L.A., Harvey Weinstein was charged with four counts of sexual assault from accusations brought by a pair of women who say that Weinstein attacked them in their hotels in Los Angeles and Beverly Hills in 2013. In New York, he's facing a maximum sentence of 25 years. In Los Angeles, 28 years.
Wow, that's a lot to get to for the frame today. Yeah,
yeah. And I think what's going to happen next is you're going to start to see what the defense strategy is going to be. I think Harvey Weinstein has maintained all along that these sexual encounters were consensual. There are a lot of people who have come forward, almost 100, who have claimed that they were sexually assaulted or worse by Harvey Weinstein. Some will get to testify in the New York case. We don't yet know when and where the LA trial is going to happen.
On a much different note, the Golden Globes were last night.
Were they?
They were. Ricky Gervais.
I skipped them.
Yeah, he made some jokes here and there. Really quick, I know the Golden Globes isn't necessarily the best predictor for the Oscar, but is there anything that we can glean from what we saw yesterday?
We can, and that is that Parasite is a great film, regardless who is voting for it. I think it's going to win the Best Directing Oscar. I think it has a shot for winning Best Picture. And as I was saying just before we came on, 1917 is also a really good movie. It won a top prize at the Golden Globes. That's Sam Mendes' World War I movie. If you haven't seen Parasite and you haven't seen 1917, go see them and also Jojo Rabbit.
I got half of that done.
Okay.
Half of the 1917, I've got to do. Okay. Oh, third. Well, two-thirds of the third. Okay. Or one-third of the third. I'll figure it out. John Horn, The Frame, 3:30. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. It's officially a new year, but some unfinished business from 2019 is still sticking around the state legislature. Talking about a bunch of bills, and they need to be acted on soon to have a chance at becoming law. Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler is here now to tell us about the legislation that he has been watching. Ben, welcome back.
It's good to be back with you.
All right. The California legislature basically has until the end of January to take action on some bills left over from 2019. And this deadline is earlier than usual. Can you explain why?
Well, every second year of a two-year legislative session, you have what's called the two-year bill House of Origin deadline. What that means is any bill that was introduced last year, started making its way through the process, and is still in the House that it started in, so a Senate bill that remains still in the Senate, an Assembly bill that is still in the Assembly, must pass its House of Origin by the end of this month, end of January in order to be able to have a chance and survive. Now, it is not the end of the world. If a bill doesn't do that, you can reintroduce a bill. The bill introduction deadline's February. But what it means is if you don't want to go all the way back to square one, back through some other committees, then you want to get your measure through your House of Origin in January. And so that makes for a much busier January in the second year of a two-year session than in the first year.
All right, so let's get to some of these bills still on the table. And let's start with Scott Wiener's housing bill. It's SB 50. What are the details on that one?
Yes, that has been probably the headliner of a rather otherwise lackluster session last year for housing bills. Of course, there's this big affordability crisis, both in lack of actual supply, housing supply, but also cost for the supply that does exist. And what Scott Wiener, a Democratic state senator from San Francisco, has sought to do is to increase the amount of development and the density, the zoning around mass transit. And he's sought to do this at the state level and has gotten a lot of pushback from the local level because locals, of course, want to make their own land use decisions. A state senator who represents the San Fernando Valley, Anthony Portantino, who chairs the Appropriations Committee, held Scott Wiener's bill last year. And so what that means is that bill is subject to this House of Origin deadline at the end of January. Wiener is going to, we hear, be proposing some amendments to that bill, and he's going to be seeking to move it forward to get it to the point where enough lawmakers will get on board with it that maybe it's not the final version of it, but it can get out of Portantino's committee, that he will release it, and then it can move to the Senate floor and get debated moving forward after that.
Talking to Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler. Then there's AB 5, which passed last year, reclassified freelancers as employees. It's been getting a lot of attention, especially from companies such as Uber and Lyft. They say they're going to ignore the law. So now what?
See, everyone thought that we were done talking about dynamics and worker classification. No, this debate is continuing. It is not going anywhere. So there are so many different fronts at play and regarding so many different industries. To recap, there was a state Supreme Court ruling nearly 2 years ago. It was unanimous, and the court at the time had four Republican appointees. And the ruling was that there is a new test for when a worker can be considered a contractor, an independent contractor, or must be designated and treated as an employee. That's important because employees get additional benefits and have worker protections, right? So you fast forward, and a year and a half after that ruling, you had some closure, kind of, in the legislature. You had this bill, AB 5, that got passed and was signed by Governor Newsom into law, and it codified that state Supreme Court ruling. It also carved out exemptions for a number of industries. The industries that were included include doctors, lawyers, you know, professions like that, also hairstylists and others. But not included were the gig companies, and they had pushed very hard for some sort of exemption or at least maybe a third way and tried to negotiate with a union. You could still be considered a contractor, but you'd be part of a union and get extra rights and benefits. That discussion did not bear fruit, and so the gig companies are going to the ballot. They are actively gathering voter signatures as we speak for a November 2020 ballot measure. Parallel, they're hoping to negotiate in the legislature, and parallel, they're filing a court challenge.
All right, lastly, another issue that might end up on the ballot, and that's split roll. What is split roll, and what might happen with it before the November vote?
The split roll involves taxing residential properties the way they are now under Proposition 13, which is based on their original purchase price rather than their fair market value, and then taking commercial industrial properties and taxing them at their fair market value. And that would lead to a big increase in property tax, which, of course, then would lead to increased revenues for the state. Money would be put toward schools and local governments, including police, fire, etc. You've got a very big battle between businesses who have benefited from this protection and argue California is a very high tax state. This is one area where there is some relief for businesses. And then progressive groups who argue that businesses are not paying their fair share, and they need to, and the money needs to be invested back into all of these other causes. That debate is a prime case for a possible compromise at the state capitol by the end of June. We understand that Gavin Newsom is interested in this. If a deal is not reached, there would be an epic, epic, costly battle if that ballot measure doesn't have a compromise.
Now, Ben, before we let you go, we should let listeners know that after nearly a decade, you'll be leaving your role in covering the state capitol. You'll be taking on a new role at your station. But let's share this reporter's notebook you put together on the polarized political debate in the legislature. It's your final piece in our California Dream collaboration series on solutions.
In the spring of 2017, when Democratic Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon shelved a single-payer health care bill.
It cost double the state budget and didn't have a funding source attached to it. It was a bill that was woefully incomplete.
The California Nurses Association posted a violent graphic to social media, a knife with the word Rendon on it, stabbing the California grizzly bear in the back. The union's Don Nielsen defended the image.
I think it represents very well what the speaker did. Yeah, he stabbed California residents in the back.
Weeks later, Governor Jerry Brown crossed party lines to negotiate a cap-and-trade deal with a bloc of Republicans. Assembly Minority Leader Chad Mays acknowledged the political risk.
What they decided was that they were going to put the people of California ahead of their own careers.
And it sure was. Influential conservatives like John Fleischman forced Mays to resign his leadership post.
Most hard-working Republican activists expect our legislators to draw a line in the sand.
Despite these pressures, some lawmakers still seek connections, compromise, and karaoke. Once a year, the legislature's cordial caucus convenes for a karaoke night with drinks and some below-average singing. Democratic State Senator Stephen Bradford told me it makes finding common ground a lot easier.
Events like this allow us to sit down outside of the party, outside the building, outside the politics, and get to know one another.
And former GOP Senator Tony Strickland said politicians do know how to disagree without being disagreeable.
If you really want stability, you need to hear what the other side's talking about and have some respect.
But your constituents, your active ones, are pressuring you to go further in one direction or another.
Without question. That's why it's incumbent upon leaders to lead.
Sometimes they do. Earlier this year, Governor Gavin Newsom and lawmakers from both parties resolved one of the nation's most polarizing debates with a compromise.
392 is now law in the state of California.
Assembly Bill 392 raised the legal standard for when police can use deadly force. After months of negotiations, the final deal drew bipartisan support. Here's its author, Democratic Assemblywoman Shirley Weber.
They always say if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together.
And here's Republican Assemblyman Tom Lackey.
When you have true leadership, really polarized positions can come together.
But it's not just politicians who must choose between tolerance and tantrums. It's the rest of us, too. It can be hard to find tolerance of the other side, even perhaps from ourselves. Yet every once in a while, there's a moment like this one, outside a Trump speech in Reno in August 2017.
Kevin, you're wearing a Make America Great Again hat?
Actually, this is signed by President Trump and his son.
And Kathy, you're holding a Black Lives Matter sign?
That's right. Made this in my backyard last night.
As police held protesters and supporters apart, there were Kevin Coffey and Kathy Blaine just talking with each other.
A little anger at first, a little bit, and now I kind of feel like he's a friend.
Love and respect your neighbor and understand that some people don't agree with what you want.
In my 20 years as a journalist, I've only felt comfortable advocating for two things. Donate to your local public radio station and vote. But as I turn in my reporting gear, I think I'm ready to add one final thing to that list. Just because you disagree with someone's political views, that doesn't make them a bad person. At the State Capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
Queen Mary has been moored in Long Beach for half a century. Now, over the years, it's been a really cool spot to take out-of-town visitors or even take a Jack and Rose picture on the big ship's bow. But the years have not been kind to the Royal Mail Ship Queen Mary, and it needs a big-time nip and tuck. Find out what needs to get fixed right away when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. For half a century, the Queen Mary has docked in the waters of Long Beach. But those 50 years have not been smooth sailing. It's been in need of repair for some time now, and full restoration of the ship might still be a long way ahead. And that future might be cast in doubt because the Queen Mary's longtime inspector has been thrown overboard by the city. It's a complex behind-the-scenes drama for a ship that was supposed to be a simple tourist attraction. Here to get us up to speed on the latest is Kelly Puentes, senior reporter for the Long Beach Post. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Now, what's the current shape of the ship, and what exactly is in need of repairs?
Well, there's a little bit of a debate over how badly the ship needs some major repairs. A marine survey done on the ship in 2016 said that the ship would need almost $300 million in repairs, and it was kind of like a jaw-dropping amount. And the city has somewhat contested that and said that it doesn't need that level of work. But there's no dispute that the ship does need some work, and certain things are looking dilapidated on the ship. One of the big things the city wants to focus on this year and the operator is the lifeboats. There's two dozen lifeboats that are in a pretty bad state of deterioration. So that's one of the big projects they're looking at now.
Now, when you said that it was originally estimated at $300 million and the city said no, what does the city now think it needs in terms of cost to fix things?
Well, they haven't given a specific sum, but 2 years ago, the city allocated through bond money with its new operator $23 million in repairs, for which they identified as urgent repairs, and they started making those repairs about 2 years ago on the ship, and the $23 million ran out as a lot of the repairs went over budget. So they're working on getting funding for some of the remaining repairs, and they've identified about two dozen what they identify as critical repairs that are needed.
So they've spent $23 million. That's all they've spent so far.
Yes. Well, the operator of the ship is responsible for funding the additional repairs. So they are likely spending more than that now, but it's not clear how much that they're spending at this point.
When did the city start to notice that the ship needed repairs, and what did it do to address things?
Well, that's a good question, because I think the current city leadership won't dispute this either, but that the city for many decades has kind of turned a blind eye to the ship needing repairs, and they rent the ship out to various operators who haven't really kept the ship on the, you know, up and up. So the ship's kind of been allowed to deteriorate somewhat, and then when the city brought in a new operator, Urban Commons, to take over the ship in 2016, that's when they commissioned this big marine survey to find out, well, how bad is it? How much does the ship really need? And so now the ship has this new level of scrutiny where they're really taking another look at what does the ship need, and what kind of repairs are there. And so they also have a new engineering department, which is going to be looking at that as well.
What has been repaired?
They've done quite a bit. They put in a whole new sprinkler system. When they got in there, they found out that the sprinkler system hadn't been touched in years and years, and they originally had budgeted something like $250,000, and it turned into a $5 million project because they had to put in a whole new sprinkler system. The fire department even declared emergency because it was like if there was a fire on board, it would have been bad. So things that they didn't realize needed repairs, there's standing water in the hull, sewer pipes, even just, you know, as far as cosmetic repairs, there's duct tape holding the carpet together in some areas, the teak wood on the decks are being redone, a lot of paint job. That's really kind of an overall, just overhaul, cosmetic and structural.
Talking about the Queen Mary with Kelly Puentes, senior reporter for the Long Beach Post. Now, all this brings us to the past few weeks and the Queen Mary's longtime inspector, Edward Pribonik. He's been inspecting the ship for over 25 years, recently was let go, accused of breaching contract. Fill us in on what's going on there.
Yes, well, Ed Pribonik has been a longtime inspector with the ship. He's a former Disney engineer. And in recent months, his inspection reports have been increasingly damning, complaining about the ship being allowed to fall into a further state of disrepair. His most recent reports, he said some very strong statements that the ship could soon be unsalvageable and is the worst he's ever seen it. And that type of language hasn't sat well with city staffers, who are saying that his language has become little more emotionally driven rather than professional engineering language, and they've said that they've asked him to elaborate on some of his broader statements, which they said that he has not. So we're really seeing a stage where the city is butting heads with its longtime engineer, who says he's been being made a scapegoat for complaining about problems on the ship, while the city is saying, you know, well, we want a professional engineering firm to come in and get a second opinion.
You've also reported that the nonprofit that's helped to restore the ship could also face a lawsuit from Long Beach. Why?
Yeah, on the other side, we have a nonprofit in the city that's been around for a couple of years, and last year they launched a campaign to raise funds for the ship to help with the repairs, and they've said that they've had trouble meeting with city staffers to figure out where to they can donate these funds and how they can launch the process for the nonprofit donating. And around this time where they were trying to meet with the city, they were served with a cease and desist letter saying that they can't use the Queen Mary logo or name in any of their fundraising projects. And for the city's part, the city is saying, you know, we've trademarked that image and that name, and we don't want anyone using it because it could be in danger of some people using it for profit. So it's really the city just working to protect their trademark image, which they have with the Queen Mary.
Yeah, but what a drama. I mean, so what happens next year? Any timeline for when the ship is expected to be fully repaired?
I don't think they have a timeline for fully repairs now. They've identified some critical projects that they really want to tackle this year. The main one being the lifeboats. There's 24 lifeboats on the ship, and it's a really big project because they have to be historically accurate, so some can be replaced, but others cannot. And so that's going to be a huge project that they're hoping to take on with extra funding.
You know, I can't imagine the city of Long Beach without the Queen Mary, but Kelly, is there any chance that Long Beach might say, you know what, the Queen Mary's too much trouble, so we need to bail out of this thing?
I hope not. You know, I mean, it's such a Long Beach icon, and I feel like they're really taking a renewed interest and scrutiny on the ship now, and I know that the city and the operator, Urban Commons, they say that they've been really dedicated to repairing the ship and keeping her for a long time. So I hope, and I think she'll be around in Long Beach for quite a while.
That's Kelly Puentes, senior reporter for the Long Beach Post, who's been following this story. Kelly, thanks a lot.
Great, thank you.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two today, come on, what gives? It's almost been a whole year that we've been at 2 o'clock. Set a calendar, an alert, something. But if you still want to hear the show, we would like you to go to anywhere you get your podcast. We will there be waiting to be heard by you with a very appreciative tone, not like the one I just gave you. All right, you are also on social media as well. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A. Martinez LA. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.